Yeah, thank you for two very wonderful selections this morning. If you were wondering about the winter attire on some of the folks, it's not because it's that cold in here. Yeah, I don't think so. That's to remind you of the Cardigan Weekend coming up a little later in the church year. There's a write-up about that in our order of service. Also, given the fullness of today's service, we're not doing a formal time of joys and concerns. If you have something you'd like posted on our UU Cares website for that, or UU Cares Network, you can jot that down on a card. They'll be on the table there at the newcomers, and we'll see that we get that up. I would call one thing to your attention. Frank Grossman's father passed away this past week. He and Kathy are not here today. Service will be held even in the Portsmouth area a little later. We'll get some more information up about that, but certainly hold Frank and Kathy and their daughters in your hearts today. As some of you know, I've had a research and writing project going on for the past year or so on some of the religious and spiritual themes in the life and work of Woody Guthrie, which I hope results in a book at some point if I can ever get myself to the end of it. It's been a fascinating pursuit as I've been able to find time to do it. On my last trip this past July to the Woody Guthrie Archives, which are housed in Mount Kisco, New York, the archivist there showed me, and I made a copy of it, an amazing, as well as an amazingly long letter that Woody Guthrie wrote to his wife Marjorie while he was serving in the United States Merchant Marine during the Second World War. He starts off by writing about a sermon his ship's chaplain gave about Moses, and he takes on from there for several handwritten pages on what he calls oneness, or the oneness of all things. He really gets going on that. I can only give you a few snippets here. Any activity of the mind which tends to show us the real oneness of all things is great. The more a song shows this oneness, the greater is that song. This is the highest activity of your mind and heart, to see all the relations and all the connections between all objects, forces, peoples, and creatures. This union is not only possible, not only probable, but it is an actual fact. It is alive and living in the people all around you. This is why all the great religions preach the central idea of oneness. That's Woody Guthrie. A Woody Guthrie who at times liked to give off the affect of kind of an aw shucks, down home, plain talking country bumpkin from Oklahoma with little in the way of a formal education. And indeed, he was from a little hamlet in Oklahoma, and he never completed high school. But he was also a self-educated scholar. He was particularly well-versed in world religions. His personal life had its share of flaws and failings, which paradoxically seems to be the case with a number of humanity's visionaries, people who can see a greater harmony in the universe while also experiencing a certain amount of disharmony in their personal lives. Such was the case with Woody Guthrie. But he did leave a very strong spiritual legacy, some of which I hope I will be able to uncover. In fact, the passage I just shared is one I plan to include in a chapter I've titled Woody the Universalist. For the sentiments he expresses in this letter, which he wrote in 1944, echo a theme that has been put forth by prophets and seers and visionaries over the course of human history. These are people who know who they are and where they are when it comes to their particular place in history, but who also look beyond it, and they attempt to call their fellow human beings in whatever historical time and place they may happen to be to catch a glimpse of what Woody calls in his letter to Marjorie the one union. Such prophets and visionaries are often lonely people. They can easily be dismissed as out of touch or otherworldly dreamers. If they happen to gain a significant following, however, they can sometimes find themselves being persecuted or even killed. Martin Luther King may have been regarded as a harmless dreamer as long as he was preaching his erudite sermons to his Birmingham, Alabama congregation about how the love of God unites people of all races, as he did for a time. But when he took that visionary message to the streets and translated it into a hard-edged call for racial equality and justice and peace, that is to say, when he put his voice or his dream on the ground, Well, we know what happened to him then. This idea of the essential unity of all persons and things, however, is not always confined to lonely prophets or visionaries. Sometimes it can even become the basis of a religion. And such was the case in this country beginning in the late 18th century with a faith tradition called Universalism, this time with a capital U. It was brought to America in 1770 from England by one Reverend John Murray, and it quickly took root in New England. Reverend Murray went on to serve as a chaplain in George Washington's Revolutionary Army. His oft-repeated message was the words the choir just sang, "Go out into the highways and byways of your new land, America. Give them something of your vision. You may possess only a small light, but uncover it and let it shine. Use it to bring more understanding to hearts and minds. Give them not hell, but hope and courage. Do not push them deeper into despair." Like many apocryphal type quotes, there's some question as to John Murray's actual authorship of this, but the words capture well the spirit of early American Universalism, whatever their source may be. And these words offered a very stark contrast to the angry and punishing God of the Calvinists of New England, most famously depicted in a sermon by the Reverend Jonathan Edwards, in which he shows God as dangling hopeless and hapless sinners over the fiery pit of hell into which they could be dropped at any time by divine whim. As a counterpoint to Edwards and his followers, the Universalists offered a God of love who would in time reconcile all of humanity unto himself. For the Universalists, Jesus then was not someone who had to die a horrible death to save us from an innate state of depravity, but rather someone who lived and taught in such a way to demonstrate that all human beings could emulate this love of God, this universal love. So these earlier Universalists regarded themselves as good and devout Christians, even though their true or real Christianity was questioned and denounced by some of the more orthodox Christians of their day. That probably sounds somewhat familiar. Well, the chief architect and proponent of this faith after Murray planted the seeds was a self-educated one-time Baptist minister from rural New Hampshire here, just west of Hereaways in Winchester, called Hosea Ballou. His base of operation eventually came to be the Second Universalist Church of Boston, which he served from 1817 until 1852. And by the latter part of the 19th century, the Universalist Church of America, as it came to be called, was, by some counts, the sixth largest Protestant denomination in America. With their ideas on human perfectibility, provided, that is, enough human effort was put forth, the Universalists contributed strongly to the ranks of many 19th century reform movements, including abolitionism, women's suffrage, public education, the humane treatment of the mentally ill, prison reform, the improvement of health care, and the like. It was 50 years ago this past spring, in May of 1961, they joined with the American Unitarian Association to form our current denomination, the UUA. Well, to return to their founding theology for just a moment longer, by the thinking of most of us Unitarian Universalists today, it would be quite quaint and antiquated. The Universalists, like most folks there, they did believe in an afterlife, and they wrestled with the idea of hell, and they came to reject the idea. For they believed that a God of love would not condemn persons to an eternity of torment for deeds done, however terrible they had been, during a temporal lifetime. So Universalism originally meant universal salvation. Everyone, that is, would eventually be saved by the love of God. Now they debated among themselves for a time as to how this final and ultimate salvation was going to be achieved, because they also wrestled and recognized the reality of evil. Some of them for a time had their own version of purgatory, wherein you had to work off some of the bad stuff you'd done on earth before being brought into or restored to a state of heavenly grace. Well, like I said, these kinds of debates among our spiritual ancestors may seem downright amusing to us now. I see a few smiles go up as I talk about this. But they were given serious deliberation at the time. And there was an underlying point they were trying to make that is still quite relevant. The underlying point they were trying to make was that no human being on earth was entirely or forever cut off from the love and grace of God, that ultimately, that is to say, we are all one. Now, the Universalist understanding of what this oneness meant changed over the course of their history. Eventually, they moved on from their debates about heaven and hell and the afterlife to look at some deeper meanings of the term universalism. They began looking for common universal themes in all the world's religious faith traditions. And like the Unitarians, the Universalists in time came to expand beyond their liberal Christian base, while, as a general rule, they held on to their original Christianity a bit longer than did their sister and brother Unitarians. Well, that's the nickel tour of Universalism in America. I titled the sermon, Can Universalism Save Us? I should at least attempt to answer my own question. And I'm going to take this on two levels. When I use the word us, I mean it in two different ways. I'm talking about us, or we, as a human race, and then I'm also talking about us, or we, as a liberal religious movement that goes by the rather unwieldy name of Unitarian Universalism. Well, let's take the first us first. I'm going to loop back to Woody Guthrie. He was partly right, when he wrote into that letter to his wife Marjorie that all great religions preach the idea of oneness. Tragically, he was not entirely right. As I said in other sermons, the great religious divide today at the global level and on down is not between the various religions of the world, but it is within them. This divide within some of the world's faiths, particularly the monotheistic ones, is between what I'm calling the exclusivists and, using my term again, the universalists. The words are really pretty self-explanatory. The exclusivists hold that their faith is the one true one, and anyone who is outside of that faith is an infidel deserving of some kind of divine condemnation. The universalists, and you can find, I'm using it with a small u now, the universalists see their faith as a piece of a larger whole, a piece of a larger truth or reality that will probably never fully be known or realized, but can still be aspired towards. Now, these kinds of universalists don't deny that there are differences among the religious faiths, but they also seek to look beyond these differences for the common ground that points us human beings to a greater awareness of our common humanity. So yes, Woody Guthrie was right when he did say that all great religions preach the idea of oneness, but he needed to qualify his statement just a bit to say that it's really certain segments within each of these great religions that preach this and teach this idea. But to update a little bit, this same point was made very well by the novelist and commentator and one-time Catholic priest, James Carroll, in one of his Boston Globe op-ed pieces that came out about 4 or 5 weeks ago. I was very taken by it. He titled it, Monotheism Doesn't Mean We're Number One. And in this piece, he writes, Carroll cites three recent incidents of which he rightly calls religious bigotry. Quoting him now, the instances were, a Texas Baptist minister who says that voters should reject any candidate who is not truly a believer in Jesus Christ. Israeli zealots in Jaffa who vandalize Muslim and Christian cemeteries. And in Cairo, Islamist mobs attacking Coptic Christians, leaving more than 24 dead. And Carroll acknowledges that these three incidents are not alike in their severity. But then he goes on to say they are alike in revealing what happens when embers of earthly conflict are fanned into flames by the heavenly justification of a twisted monotheism. He's referring to a stance that basically says, my God is better than your God, or more ominously, my God can lick your God. Whatever one's own beliefs or lack thereof may be, I think Carroll's larger point is well worth heeding and the question it raises. Do we use religion as a way of exacerbating our differences or as a way of moving beyond them? Carroll once more, what if monotheism is not about being number one? To say, as the book of Genesis does, that God is the creator of all that exists, not just of the tribe, means that all creatures are alike and participating in God's life, or in the life of the universe, if Carroll's theistic language is a stumbling block to some of you. Continuing with him, this vision of oneness, interesting, he's using the same language as Woody Guthrie here, this vision of oneness is what launched the religion known as Judaism, what motivated Jesus, what gripped Muhammad. If Judaism has survived through the millennia, and if both Christianity and Islam have seized the imagination of multitudes, the core reason is not a spirituality of combat, but belief in the promise of peace. Well, whether or not then one is an adherent of any one of these religions to which Carroll speaks, whether or not one has any use for religion at all for that matter, it is what this ex-priest calls a vision of oneness that is the key phrase in his entire piece. This was a vision caught by our Universalist and our Unitarian forebears. It is a vision caught by any of those individuals over the course of human history who have called us to our better selves and who have helped or at least tried to move us in the direction of what 19th century Unitarian minister Theodore Parker called the universe's arc of justice, who tried to move that arc just a little further along. So to answer my own question then, in the sense that I posed it, can universalism save us as a human race and as a planet? I'd say it's either universalism, it's either a vision of oneness that saves us, or nothing at all. We all indeed do come from that everything seed. Maybe someday we'll actually figure that out, along with all that it means. I also, you may recall, posed the same question in a more in-house sense with respect to our own liberal religious movement and denominational body. Let me speak to that for a few minutes before I close for today. As already noted, the Unitarians and the Universalists each got their toeholds in this country in the latter part of the 18th century. They grew into and they operated as religious bodies during the 19th and 20th centuries. In terms of belief and practice, they had far more similarities than differences, and yet it took them until 1961 to combine. This was largely because they were separated much more by class or social status than they were by their beliefs. I know and I'll acknowledge there are exceptions that can be found on both sides of this formula, but by and large, the Universalists have more of a working class, plain folks, farmer or small town merchant makeup to their congregations, the kind of people that Woody Guthrie would have gravitated towards. They were people who were sustained and nurtured in the midst of their hardworking lives in the belief that they were loved and cared for by a loving and caring God. The Unitarians, again with a broad brush here, were more of the landed gentry or the educated elite of their day. They contributed mightily to the social, intellectual, educational and cultural life of 19th century New England and beyond. And like the Universalists, they contributed much to the reform movements of those times. But these two bodies and their constituencies, again, by and large, moved in very different social and economic circles. Perhaps it was the 19th century Unitarian minister, whose father was a Universalist preacher, the Reverend Thomas Starr King, who stated these differences most cryptically when he observed that the Universalists believe that God is too good to damn them. The Unitarians believe they're too good to be damned by God. Always like that. It is a good line. I got to wonder, what does it have to do then with Universalism saving, or at least broadening, our current liberal religious movement? I offer this. Our Universalist ancestors demonstrated quite well that liberal religion can cut across and transcend class lines, that it does not have to be the province entirely of the professional class or of the educated elite. I say this to take nothing away from the careers many of you have or the levels of education many of you have achieved. For myself, I am proud of the fact, in fact, that my three sisters and I were able to grow up in a struggling working class home and then go on to earn master's degrees, all four of us, and enter the careers to which our degrees gave us access. And two of us, of those four, those careers were the Unitarian Universalist ministry. But I continue to be struck by how our Universalist ancestors could put forth a very simple message, one that was at the same time quite profound, that the love of God is available to all, that we can form loving congregations based on this greater love, and they had that message resonate across a very broad spectrum of the American public. And I've come to believe at this latter stage of my time in the Unitarian Universalist ministry that the future life and vitality of our movement depends upon our putting forth an equally broad and appealing message and mission. It need not, it will not, contain the same language as 19th and early 20th century universalism. But how about a message from us to whoever can hear it or whoever cares to hear it that says, you are part of a greater love, of a greater spirit of life that enfolds us all. You are loved and blessed by that which is greater than you know. And we offer a welcoming community where in the company of seekers, you can learn more of what this greater love is all about. And you can be a part of it. And you can act on it. And act on it for others. That is the truth our Universalist forebears were attempting to live out, however they may have expressed it, certainly in much more theistic language than we would use now. But it is a truth that I have found embodied in this congregation in the years I have served it. I witnessed that spirit just this past week and all those meals that were served in our dining hall for those within our congregation as well as others who needed a warm and lighted place to be and some well-prepared food to eat. I think that spirit of love and care came through most wonderfully. I hope the spirit of the message I just suggested is one that can find even greater resonance, not only in this congregation, but in our sister and brother congregations around this land. For I believe that the more this message is heard, really heard, the stronger we will be and the more diverse we will become as Unitarian Universalists. This is the highest activity of your mind and heart, this oneness, to see all the relations between all objects, forces, people, and creatures. This union is alive and living in the people all around you. All great religions preach the central idea of oneness. So wrote Woody Guthrie, even as he was working on a ship that was part of a war effort in the deadliest war ever waged to that point in human history. A paradox, perhaps, but still striking that even in the midst of one of humanity's greatest imperfections, that is to say, the waging of war, Woody Guthrie was able to see through and beyond that imperfection to a greater truth. In the midst of brokenness, he held up a vision of oneness. And here we are, members of a small but hearty liberal religious body that also seeks to hold up such a vision in an oftentimes broken world. Let us take encouragement from those of this faith who have gone before us. And let us keep our eyes fixed on the prize of the day when earth shall be fair and all her people one. Let's sing about that together. We would be one. It's hymn number 318.